it was something I felt, like I had a sense that this eightfold path was not, that the fourth noble truth was not just about the eightfold path. So we couldn't come to an agreement, kind of parted ways, like we're not going to talk about this anymore, kind of parted ways. And I then went on a mission to go find out what was this fourth noble truth about. Basically to prove that my friend was wrong. That's why I went on the mission. So I started reading everything I could find. It's actually the time when I found my book that I loved by Ajahn Sumedho. So it's about the reading everything, and I looked at the sutta and I listened to all these Dhamma talks and talk after talk, book after book, commentary after commentary. They said the fourth noble truth is about the eightfold path. But I didn't believe that. I mean, I think I heard it intellectually, but I didn't believe it. And I want to help you see why I couldn't believe it. And sometimes if we let these tensions just stay there and not just smooth over them, we can get access to a much deeper wisdom. So the reason why my friend and I had that fight, this little, I'm going to call it a debate. It was a fight though. The reason why is because I had quit smoking. And when I quit smoking, you guys know that it was just this thing that Rodney said, used to talk about me smoking. He didn't talk about me smoking, but it felt like me because I was the only one standing outside smoking. So I'm just saying that as a side. But he would talk about smoking. And I took offense to it, went to him and said, you can't say that. Because, you know, smoking is a habit. It's not that easy. You don't smoke, you don't know. And so his whole point was that he did not want me to stop smoking. He just wanted me to pay attention to it. And I'm like, yeah, that's nothing. I can do that. Okay, that's it. So I went on this agreement with him, this commitment that I was going to pay attention every time I wanted to have a cigarette. And in the course of my paying attention, within a week, I did not want to smoke anymore. That was it. I was done with the whole thing. And I could not stop smoking, so I found a hypnotist, got hypnotized, and within 2 weeks I wasn't smoking anymore. The whole thing was like so quick and done. And so my thinking when I was talking to my friend was that the path was my going to a hypnotist, and that it kind of liberated me from the curse of smoking, because anybody that smokes for a long period of time, it can get a little cursy. We say we like it, but really it's like kind of a burden. And so I thought the liberation came from the act of going to a hypnotist, and it didn't have anything to do with the path, the eightfold path. There was nothing holy or sacred about it. And so when I kept reading all these things pointing to the Eightfold Path, I kept thinking, but that's too narrow. It's more broader than that. And then one day I was sitting at Blodell Hall, was during a meditation, and I was just sitting there beginning to get very still. Very quiet, very still, and this thought came across my mind that the Eightfold Path had nothing to do with conduct, that it was what enabled me to look at the smoking, that the Eightfold Path was something that I had cultivated in order for me to look at the suffering and the difficulty and stay with this promise to watch the smoking that I had made with Rodney. And that is what the Eightfold Path was about. And it became, the thing that struck me is I thought to myself that the minute I started looking at the nature of smoking seriously. Not this kind of, oh, I don't want to smoke anymore, but seriously staying with it. The minute I did that, it was pretty much over. I was never going to go back to smoking. I didn't know that before. And I was sitting there at Bloater Hall, and it hit me that I thought the path was what we did to change our conduct. And what I realized is that the path is what we do to help us see those things that are disrupting our lives and causing us all this difficulty. So what I thought I would do for the evening is to talk about how the path is in that relationship, how it is this eightfold path. And it's not so much that if we could actually let go of conduct, I think, if we could just stop thinking of our conduct. It's such a bold statement that I'm saying out here, but we are obsessed over conduct, how we act, how other people act. Is that acting right? Are you acting wrong? And we get obsessed in this how we are as people. I remember going on a long retreat one time, and the teachers said probably no less than 50 times, there's no such thing as a bad yogi. Yep, that's what they call retreatants, yogis. There's no such thing as a bad yogi. Doesn't matter what you do, we're all on retreat here, things come and go, there's no such thing as a bad yogi. And then you spend the rest of the retreat pointing out all the bad yogis. Oh yeah, they're really messing up, there's a bad yogi there. And all of that pointing is at people's conduct. They're not following the rules. One teacher said during one of the instruction periods, there are no rules here. So anything anybody's doing, they're not violating any rules. And you hear that. Just like I heard that, you know, the Fourth Noble Truth is about the Eightfold Path. But inside I think, yeah, but that's a problem right there. You're not supposed to do that. Look at them. Look what they're doing. They're talking and doing their yogi job. Oh, bad yogi. So we obsess over this conduct. What we miss by obsessing over the conduct is the energy behind the conduct. So we can't see that some of the meanest people we know are very sad. We can't see that some of the angriest, most brutal people are deeply wounded and deeply hurting. So the idea of having compassion for someone whose conduct is cruel and brutal is just unthinkable. That's not possible, because we're looking at the conduct, not what happens, not the energy behind it. So one way I begin to think about the Eightfold Path is I begin to think of it as the cultivation of energy. It's the cultivation of some kind of energetic feel that connects us to all these altruistic, kind, and beautiful things that we want to be. Or you could think of it as the path is about potentiality. It's about possibility. I think that's the only reason why we call it a liberation path, is because the path itself is really about what's possible if you turn away from conduct and cultivate the energy behind the conduct. So I used to teach nonviolent communication and mindfulness in prisons, and I did for a long time. And so if you're sitting in a circle with a group of people who have been in prison, or they have spent their lives in violent worlds, this idea of trying to talk in a nonviolent way or change their behavior, it becomes this obsession that I need to change my behavior so this, I will not end up here again. And I would get bombarded with all these questions like, well, how can I use this nonviolent communication or stillness when my girlfriend is acting stupid on the phone? You know, and it's like, I'll never forget someone said that they didn't know they hit someone until they saw them lying on the ground, and then they knew they had hit someone. So how do you know this ahead of time is what they wanted to know. And it took a while for me to help them see that you're not trying to change your conduct. You're trying to change the energy that shows up at different times. And the energy, that capacity, your resilience, who you are, this natural part of you affects your conduct. But the cultivation is something much more subtler than that. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about how the path is laid out. I want to talk more. So first of all, the path is laid out in a sequencing set, but we're going to talk about that more towards the end of the month. Not so much tonight, but it's taught in a sequence of eight, like they're called factors, and some people call them elements, and some people call them components, but it's these eight aspects, and they're sequenced, taught in a sequence. And just as an aside, Tim and I are going to talk about these out of sequence, just so that we can, just because I'm leaving towards the end of the year, so that'll just come. But anyway, they're taught in a sequence, but they're not linear, so we don't actually learn them. I think something that Bhikkhu Bodhi said is probably a good way to begin to think about them. He said that a well-developed path, or the Eightfold Path, is more like the intertwining strands of a strong cable, so that each strand contributes to the strength of the cable, and together they make the cable much stronger than each strand would be on its own. And so these eight factors, aspects, whatever you want to call them, they kind of intertwine together. And not only do they intertwine together, each one of these eight that we're going to talk about over the course of the year, they also have a phrase right in front of them. So it's not just an aspect like understanding or view. It's the right view. And so before we get caught into this idea when we start talking about right view, right understanding, right conduct, that we might get trapped in our ideas of what is right and what is wrong. But the right is not connected to a right or a wrong. What Joseph Goldstein said, that the right is in relation to the three truths. So basically, if you want to understand the truth, right, the first noble truth, the second noble truth, the third noble truth, the truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, and the truth of the cessation of suffering, then the path is the right view that you take in order to see the three other truths. It's not whether or not it's the right understanding or the right view for, you know, dealing with politics. It's whether or not it's the right view for you to be able to see the suffering that's showing up in the moment, whether you can see the origin of that suffering, and whether you can see a way towards the liberation of that suffering or the cessation of that suffering. So that's what the right stands for. It's the correct way in order to see the other truths. And then these eight factors are then divided up into three different parts. One is for wisdom, easy way to remember it. One is for wisdom, and wisdom is both the right understanding, some people call it right view, and then right intention. And it's been called right intention, right aspiration, or right thought. That's the first wisdom group. Then there's a morality group, or people call it a conduct group. Discipline, moral discipline is what it's been called, and that is right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then the last group is concentration. And so concentration is right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And that's how you begin to remember the three. Probably the best example that I ever heard anybody give to explain the Eightfold Path and cultivating these different is Kitasaro gave an analogy that I want to share with you, how he helped us understand the Eightfold Path and its relationship with each other. So he said that imagine that you live on the near side of a raging river that's just like raging all the time. And you want to get over to the far side of that river. And first you try to swim through the river, and of course it just swish you away. You try to take a boat and row over and push you away. Now you can go all the way around and take several hours or days to go all the way around the river to get to the other side. And eventually you can get there. But what would really help you get there is a bridge that just goes right across. So you can think of the conduct, the moral discipline aspect of the Eightfold Path as on the near side of the bridge. It's right, the near side of the river. It's right here. It's easy to access, and you can put a pole down on this side, and it's pretty easy to do. You can see your conduct. You can see your speech. It's pretty clear when your speech, your conduct is causing harm or difficult or causing, you can feel the suffering in relation to our conduct. So to see that and to work on that, it's pretty easy. You can put a little stake down on this side. Now you can go all the way around. It's a little difficult to get all the way around, but once you get on the other side, you can put a post in that side. It's pretty easy because you're on that side now. And that's your wisdom side. So it takes a little bit to see the wisdom, to come in right relationship with the wisdom. But once you begin to have a relationship with this wisdom, both the understanding, the view, and the intention, you can put a pole on that side. He said the difficult pole to put in is the one that you have to put in the middle of the raging river. And that is our concentration. That's our steadiness of mind, our mental stability. And we're putting that pole down in the middle of a raging river. It's understanding that that stability is difficult to do. But once you get that stability down in the center of that river, you can string a rope across all three and walk easily across. So we work on the conduct, which is close at hand. We work on wisdom and beginning to see how we are, our intentions and our view in situations. But either way, the most steady and the most difficult aspect of the path is the stake down in the middle of that raging river, which is what we work on when we're constantly working on our practice. So another way to think about this, it's not about conduct. That's one way to think about it. It's more about the potentiality that we have in any given moment. We're training the mind to turn in a certain direction, even when we ourselves can't turn in that direction. And another way to think about it is that it's an inward journey. So we're less concerned with outward stuff and more concerned about an inward journey. There's a quote by a famous Japanese priest named Dogen who says, to study the Buddha's way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad of things. When actualized by myriad of things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So if I haven't learned anything about this practice, I've learned one thing. It's taken me a while to learn this, but I have learned one thing. That there is no accomplishment on this path. You're not going to actually accomplish anything. It's spiritual, so it's no accomplishment. So even if I have had, over the course of the 25 some years I've been practicing, great moments of stillness, this breathtaking stillness, I still fight with my thinking mind all the time. So there's not a sense that I can somehow get to this place and then, oh, I'm good now. I think there's a way that you can gradually have, I have more and more and more ease whether the mind is thinking a lot or not. So I don't get caught like I used to in fighting with the thinking mind. But as long as I believe I'm not enlightened, I will always be struggling with the thinking mind. So this idea that I'm going to have this great meditative accomplishment kind of goes out the window. I've also had experiences of non-self that are equally mind-blowing. Like, oh, that's it. I have the sense that I have arrived. And then I can equally get into a major disagreement with someone. And the self is all there, and I don't even see it. I don't even know that I'm like arguing and fighting. I can be in a tense little back and forth with someone, and I can't tell. Maybe when I get home, I'll think about it and say, oh, geez, what was that? How did that happen? So I can't really get lost too much in this idea that I've somehow made it over, I've reached a certain pinnacle, because I still get caught. Or I could be moved to tears with kindness, things of compassion, just the felt sense of it, and be just as stingy as the next person. Just like, I worry about whether I'm going to give something to somebody, get caught in it. So I let go some years ago of the notion that this path was going to make me a better person. I let go of that idea that I even had to be a better person. In fact, if I found myself getting too caught in trying to be a better person, it's like a red flag for me now. Because that means there's too much selfing going on and too much trying to be someone. And that is going in the opposite direction of where the path is going to take us. So if we're going to let go of the self, it's kind of a strange phenomenon here. You're going to let go of the self and then you're going to be on a path and cultivate it. There's somebody doing the cultivating, I think. So what we're trying to do is see if we could let go of control or let go of the need to control something. Just let it be. Maybe let go of our sense of what is righteousness, what is right, and the need for something to be right or correct, fixed or something like that. Something like learning how to just accept whatever difficulty, pain or injustice, cruelty, all this messiness of life that we really don't like. It's finding a way to actually accept that messiness, that injustice, that cruelty, that stuff that we think cannot be, that's exactly what happens in life. And it is there. So I thought I would take a moment to read some quotes from people who have talked about spiritual paths. And if you would like to, I'd invite you just to close your eyes and listen to some of these, some things that people have said. Stephen Levine said, "Safety is the most unsafe spiritual path you could take. Safety keeps you numb and dead. People are caught by surprise when it's time to die. They have allowed themselves to live so little." Pema Chodron says, "So many of us start along the spiritual path because we're suffering. But you must realize that for real healing to occur, there must first be deep compassion for yourself, especially the parts of yourself you dislike or consider ugly." Marianne Williamson said, "The spiritual path is simple. No, the spiritual path is simply the journey of living our lives. Everyone is on a spiritual path. Most people just don't know it." Rumi, "The spiritual path wrecks the body and afterward restores it to health. It destroys the house to unearth the treasure, and with that treasure builds it better than before." Deepak Chopra says, "Not every sky will be blue, and not every day is springtime. So on the spiritual path, a person learns to find this kind of happiness without needing things to happen on the outside. Rather, you find happiness by being who you really are. This isn't mystical. Young children are happy being who they are. The trick is to regain such a state when you are grown and have seen the light and dark sides of life." Trungpa Rinpoche said, "Walking the spiritual path properly is a very subtle process. It is not something to jump into naively. There are numerous sidetracks which leads to a distorted, egocentric version of spirituality. We can deceive ourselves into thinking we are developing spiritually when instead we are strengthening our egocentricity through spiritual techniques. This fundamental distortion may be referred to as spiritual materialism." So Jack says, "To undertake a genuine spiritual path is to not avoid difficulties, but to learn the art of making mistakes wakefully, to bring them to the transformative power of the heart." How about a couple of more? Tara Brock says, "The great gift of a spiritual path is coming to trust that you can find a way to true refuge. You realize that you can start right where you are in the midst of your life and find peace in any circumstance, even in those moments when the ground shakes terribly beneath you. When there's a loss that will alter your life forever, you can still trust that you will find your way home. This is possible because you've touched the timeless love and awareness that are intrinsic to who you are." Let's see. Here's a couple of ones from people I don't even know. Alan Cohen said that the spiritual path is not one of attainment, but of return. And Bo Lazoff says, in some respects, if I had to choose just one virtue on the spiritual path, I'd feel safest with a sense of humor. We pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, have a good laugh about human nature, and get on with our journey. So that's this thing we're trying to do. We're looking inward. We're not looking outward to try to see if we can adjust our conduct to become a certain way. We are, this path that we're going to take up over the next 8 months is about actually turning inward with the messiness, the stuff that doesn't go right, the ugliness, whatever it is, without a judgment that it should somehow or another be better. We're just trying to get to know this truer nature of who we are and let that potentiality change us. So that leads me to this last part. The last thing I think we're looking for, I wish I had brought the sutta with me, but if you remember, when I read the sutta, what struck out is that Buddha said that he had seen something that had not been heard before. So we are trying to experience life in a way we have not heard before. Some notes I left for myself is, anything you know right now, that's not the path. So this kind of this sense that I had this knowing of what I thought the path was, that's not it. It's looking for something that you don't know right now. It's a kind of a strange thing to look into the unknown or the mystery of it. But if you look to verify and, you know, solidify what you already know, you will miss it. Just like I tried to solidify my position, I was looking for evidence of the truth of my position, and I kept missing all the truth of what was actually the path was about. So I was saying on Sunday, at the Sunday sit, that I think the more I practice and the more I work with all of these teachings, they all boil down to a level of kindness and a level of compassion that we do not know. We do not practice. Meaning that everybody in this room can easily be kind to the people we like. We can easily be kind to the people we love or the things that we like, the things that are agreeable to us. We can easily be nice around that. But what it takes is, can we be kind, nice, lovable in the midst of things we don't like? In the midst of being around people we don't like? Being in a world around stuff that we don't like? That something about that is very different. In fact, it's so different that this is what Buddha was telling people 2,600 years ago. He was saying, it's about kindness. It's about love in a different way. And even then, to the people he was talking to then, it was hard for them to do it. There's something about this idea of being kind or caring or connected, loving, when everything around you is going in the opposite direction. It's ugly, it's nasty, it's not kind, it's cruel, it's mean. And everything in our minds tells us that we should not be kind in those kind of situations. But that's what I think this practice is pointing to. Somehow it's pointing to something that's far more unique, and that uniqueness is what it is that pulls us to people like the Buddha. It pulls us to people like Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Moses and Muhammad, all these people who were kind in the face of otherwise very difficult things. It seems impossible to do, but I think that's what the practice is asking of us. I think the reason why I quit smoking, finally, I mean, I'd been trying to quit smoking for years, so I think the reason why I actually quit smoking is because what I did for that week was to kindly, gently watch what I was doing. That's it. I didn't judge it. In fact, I was only doing it because I was going to go back to Rodney and say, see, you were wrong. That's the way lawyers think. We always think like that. Just prove them wrong. But because I had this belief that he was wrong, then I was kindly, gently gathering information. And what I saw instead was how much pain it was causing me, how much difficulty this was causing me, how much I didn't like it. I saw it more for what it really was, truly was, how it was affecting my life truly. And then the quitting part was just finding the path that was going to make that work, whatever it was. And I was on a mission. I can't even tell you guys how many people I called. I was on a mission. Until I found this woman that says, I can guarantee it. That was it. So one more way to think about this. The reason why we can't trust the mind, the reason why we can't trust conduct, our behavior, if I just tell myself, will myself to stop doing something, has to do with the nature of the way our minds are. We have brains that are very complicated, very intricate. You can look, talk with all kinds of doctors that deal with the mind. Neurologists, that's it, neurologists. And they will tell you that neurons who fire together stay together, right? They are wired together, they fire together. So what it means is that every single act that we have done over our lifetime, and some of us have been doing these acts for a long, long time, they're all glued together. It ensures that we are going to keep doing that and we are not going to do something different. So the only way we could really affect the energy around us is one way. And that is to begin to cultivate the firing and wiring of different neurons together, something different, and cultivate that so that it begins to fire. It fires on its own without us having to somehow make it work, somehow make ourselves better. That we cultivate a different way of being, and in the cultivating of that different way of being, different way of looking, different way of seeing, something shifts, something changes, and we become kinder. Who knows how? But we become more in line with who we really want to be. So I think I'll leave it there. Thank you. Let's take a moment and sit for a bit, just so we can be quiet. Okay, so let's take some questions. There's something about Dhamma that I want you guys to know, that you hear it, you sit with it, and you reflect on it a little bit. But there's something about speaking it out loud. And I know asking questions is probably the most difficult thing in the world to do. Or even making comments. You don't necessarily have to make questions. But there's something about saying out loud things that come up in the process of our contemplating Dhamma that creates synergy, and it just puts that potentiality into reality, makes it something, you know, sends out sparks that way. So I'm just saying that to encourage you not to be afraid to say something. You don't have to, but don't be afraid. It's okay. I'm not Rodney. So I've asked questions with Rodney sitting up here. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't the Fourth Noble Truth go, there is a way out of suffering, comma, and that way is the Eightfold Path?
Yes.
So, like, there is room to think that there's something else in there.
Thank you! That's what I was saying! So the comment was, or the question was, you know, I guess it was like a comment question about the path saying that there, the sutta saying that there, there is a way out of suffering, and that way is the Eightfold Path. And if I'd brought the sutta, it would sound even more direct that it's about the Eightfold Path, that it's actually the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And the reason why I think it was good that I couldn't see that is because the Eightfold Path points to energy. It doesn't affect conduct at all. I mean, it's not, even though we're going to talk about speech and we're going to talk about conduct, like the precepts and things like that, it seems like we're talking about conduct. But really, even the precepts is more like a promise to undertake the training. So it's almost like you're not looking at the actual conduct as much as you're concerned about your promise to undertake the training of something. So it really is about the Eightfold Path, and it's more that I was dwelling on the conduct of not smoking. But where the path is important is on the capacity for me to stay with something that was uncomfortable, to see that I really needed to quit smoking. It was more of that. So the path wasn't the thing that I used to quit smoking. What liberated me was the fact that I saw the true suffering that was coming from smoking. Do you see what I'm saying? Even though I totally agree with you, I think there's got to be some room in there. Yes.
So the smoking, I'm drawing an analogy between my looking at, you know, like scrolling through headline news. Mm-hmm. Websites, and how that's related to the compassion or lack of for self, and how that's drawing me. I'm interested in looking at that from the perspective of, you know, smoking, and how could that be
honed in that way?
Yeah.
How you could use the same analogy for that, for that suffering that you have.
Looking at and noticing as I was sitting that it, I think it's related to, I mean, I could
So I think the question is, how can I take the analogy of my quitting smoking and apply it to a situation in your life where you also have difficulty or it's causing you suffering, and it just so happens in your case it's the looking through the headlines and all the pain that comes with that. Is that what you're saying? Okay. So a way to think about it is this. how do I say? Smoking is painful. That's the thing I didn't notice, right? It's so the compassion would be to have you agree to sit and look at those headlines, and instead of getting caught in what the people are doing or whether they should be doing it, but just feel what it's doing to you as you sit there and go through these headlines. Because there's a part of us that's going through the headlines to kind of like know what's going on and be a part of the thing. And there's all this stuff that we're doing. That's what I was trying to tell Rodney. The smoking was just something I do. And he doesn't do it, so you're judging me, but you shouldn't do that. He just wanted me. It's okay if you look at headlines, but you need to know what kind of pain is coming to you when you're looking at these headlines. You need to see what's going on in your mind, what's going on in the body, what's happening to you. The Eightfold Path is the path that gives us the capacity to sit there and do this without getting lost in what the headlines are saying. To feel the up and down in the body, to feel the reactivity of this, to see our minds go crazy every time we see something or hear something, and to feel into the pain of that. When you do that, the possibility of action that can arise in how I should respond, what's the appropriate response for me, will come out of that. It doesn't come from trying to decide, should I put this away so I don't experience it? And it doesn't come from, well, I should be able to do this and be more steady and get it together. You know, I should be able to look at these headlines and not be thrown about. The better thing is for you as an individual to look at these headlines, see what it's doing to you, and then decide what's the appropriate thing to do in the midst of your difficulty. And the going to a hypnotist came to me when I had this realization, I have to stop right now, and I don't know how to do it. I've tried everything, nothing worked. So I had never tried hypnotism, and so I tried it. And luckily for me, it worked. So many people, it doesn't work, but it did. You know, maybe that means I have a mind that can be, you know, tricked. But that's, you see the analogy? The point is to stay with the difficulty and not do something to make the difficulty less difficult. It's the staying power when things are difficult that the path helps us do. Yeah. With the news, the headlines? Mm-hmm. Yes. So I guess what you're saying, so the comment is that it was similarly with her phone. She would look at the phone and she started noticing how unsatisfying looking at this phone is, like this, the disenchantment of it, right? And so from my perspective, so now she just puts the phone down, but now she's bored, right? So what I'm thinking is, from my perspective, is the putting down the phone is the easy way out, right? It's sort of like you want to stay with the phone and ask yourself, it's in that midst of difficulty, what do I do with this? Or if you put the phone down and you're bored, you don't even need the phone because now the new issue is the boredom. Can you just stay with the boredom and see what it is that makes this boredom so unpleasant. It's pretty much what you're trying to look for. I mean, I guess the best way to say it is, it's unpleasant. And we have a tendency to immediately think the cessation of unpleasant is to get rid of the unpleasant. That seems simple, pretty easy. But that is the trick. You're trying to do something that you have not seen before. So in other words, the practice is there to help you stay with that boredom, not leave it. That's the sticking your pole down in the middle of the rushing river. Stay right there with that boredom and feel into the pain of it. Not just, so I had to, okay, so think about it like this. When your thing that you're looking at is smoking, you know, smokers smoke constantly. You guys probably don't know that, but I'm telling you, we do. So putting down the phone and noticing the boredom is something you're going to do over an extended period of time. That's why the practice becomes so important. You're looking at that boredom over and over and over and over. And you are not going to try to figure out, how do I get rid of this boredom? How do I fix the boredom? You don't need to try to fix it. It's trusting that the awareness of what to do comes out of your staying with that boredom. The most difficult thing is to stay with the boredom, though, because the mind will do whatever it can to somehow or another make it not boring anymore. I mean, I actually promised Rodney that I would stay with the impulse to have the cigarette all the way through to having it, and then I could let it go then. But as soon as I had the impulse to have a cigarette again, I had to stay with it. I never knew that within 10 seconds after I finished smoking and was on my way on the elevator, the impulse to have another cigarette would be there. And I would think to myself, well, I haven't actually started yet. I can stop it now. And then it would be sort of like this, I gotta stay with this all the way upstairs, all the way while I'm working, until I actually let myself go have a cigarette. But I was amazed at how often I wanted to have a cigarette. I mean, it was constant all the time. And I never saw that. I only saw this kind of impulse out of the blue, like maybe once every couple hours or so, and have an impulse. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go have a cigarette. And then it's gone after a couple of minutes. No big deal. I did not realize the consumption of my mind around smoking. So the ability to do that is what you're trying to cultivate. The Eightfold Path is what helps you actually cultivate your ability to stay with something that you don't like without it having to go away, and kind of wait for the wisdom to know what to do. Anything short of that is giving up too soon. It's coming right back around again. Anything else?
Just, really, I'm curious about that gap between the waiting and the staying with and the arrival of the wisdom, because it's like, and then a miracle happens. You know, it seems like
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But the only thing I can offer. So the comment was that it's like this. The wait. You know, the difficulty happens. The waiting through the difficulty, and then the wisdom comes, like it's a miracle. It's not a miracle. It really isn't. It isn't a miracle. I just don't know how. The only thing I can say is this. There is a doing that happens. I did do something to change the smoking. That that's true. I did something to change the smoking. So it didn't just magically, I don't want to smoke anymore. It wasn't like that. But I think the best way to say it is I had to be sufficiently sick and tired of smoking to get to a place where I would move away and do something. So what the practice actually helped me do was to stay with that unpleasantness of smoking until I was done. Until I could see it clearly for what it is. That's what you're trying to do. But what we think is, the minute I feel something unpleasant, like, oh, I can see it. I know, this is not good. Okay, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm going to try to give it up. But there's not enough resolve, I guess, is the best way to say it. And so we try to give it up, but then it comes right back. And these habits that we have, they just come right back. They just come right back. So I had to stay with the uncomfortableness of a difficult process. Just stay there. There's no running away from it. There's no trying to find a way to fix it. I don't know how to... I can't say words that would ever get you to trust this. I can't say words that someone says, oh, okay, I'm just going to stay with the difficulty and eventually it's going to change. Because really the mind is thinking, well, we're going to give it about 10 minutes. And if something hasn't happened, we're done with that. That isn't working. That's crazy making. That's not working. So you have to be willing to stay until the wisdom comes. And the wisdom is not connected to you trying to figure out what to do. It's connected to a surety. There's a surety about what to do. And then you just do it. And that's the knowing the appropriate way to respond that we never get to because we're so convinced that it's not going to work. And then we stop. And then we just do what we want to do. But I'm not saying that it's the right way or the wrong way. All I know is in every instance that I've ever been able to let go of something, to let it go, I mean ceasing my attachment, glued stickiness to it, I have to wait. And I have to stay with the difficulty until I have a clear understanding of how to walk away. And then I can just walk away. The resolve, the capacity, my disenchantment with it, disengagement, the passion, all of it, it's gone. But to interrupt that process at any point, like if the passion is still a little bit there, but you turn away, that passion will come back around and catch you again. It's like an argument. You know, we tend to just want to get that argument out of our head. I just don't want to think about that anymore. I need to stop. It's just too, I get too upset. Every time I think about it, I get upset. I don't want to talk about it anymore. But really, you have to sit there in that sit. Let that thing churn around, and feel into what it's doing to you. And when you start feeling into what it's doing to you, feeling into what it's doing to you, you begin to see it on a different level. You see it for the deluded nature that it is. That's what frees us. It's the seeing of the delusion that this thing is going to make something better. That this thing is gonna, that somehow I have to fix this, or I gotta get it correct, or I need to control this, or this needs to not be like this, or that deluded nature that the mind has. It's almost like you have to sit until you see that delusion. And when you see it, you're not going to fall for it. It's like me telling you that there's Santa Claus. You'd be like, okay, Tori. I'm like, really? I'm telling you, there's Santa Claus. I've seen him. He has a red coat. And He's white, and he has white hair. You'll be like, okay, Tawari, that's good. You just keep thinking that. But I will not be able to convince you that it's real. And that's what you're waiting to see, the true nature of what it is, and see the delusion of it. And that, the only way we can do that is with the Eightfold Path. We have to have these cultivated aspects in place so we can stay with it. Yeah, we'll take one more.
Okay, I'll be quick. So what I heard you talk about was like, it's like wisdom precedes conduct, like your conduct changes because you have better wisdom. And I was thinking about that because it doesn't seem to quite square with my own experience where, you know, I started meditating seriously and then I was like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. So then I stopped, you know, I gave up intoxicants. And then I saw, wow, this really seems to be working well. So it was like more of a dialogue than a, you know, a totally organic, like, thing. It was like, you know, I'm going to give this up because it's a precept, and this thing seems to be going somewhere, so I'm going to, you know, it wasn't totally organic in the way that you seem to be saying.
You mean, so I think your comment is that you're thinking, I'm saying wisdom comes before conduct, and the wisdom helps you then adjust your conduct?
Yeah, like basically your conduct will just organically change once you have
to... Okay, yeah, so that your conduct kind of organically changes. And I don't want to give that impression, because that's not what I'm really trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that every difficult thing that we do or that's in our lives, there is an origin of that difficulty. And it is not the thing out there that's difficult that we don't like. That's not the origin of the difficulty that a spiritual practice is going to look at. So what I'm saying is that until you are clear with the difficulty, as long as you have some attachment, some connection to that difficulty, that your ability to let it go is a force of will. And this practice isn't about a force of will. But the way inward, I think this is what the Eightfold Path is pointing to, is this ability to be with difficulty without it having to change until we can understand the nature of it. That's what you're trying to see. The changing of conduct, so the decision to quit smoking, the decision to let go of intoxicants, to get clean and sober, all those decisions that affect conduct. I guess what I'm trying to say is that's not how you changed your life. It's not the conduct of the hypnotist. That's what I thought was the point of practice, to get me to find a way to stop smoking, or to get me to find a way to stop drinking or stop using. What I'm saying is, in order for you to get to the point where you're willing to stop using, you had to have a level of wisdom about what the alcohol or the drugs or the smoking is doing to you. And it has to be at a level when you have had enough of it and you are not going to deal with it anymore. And the way that we get to that level where we've had enough of it is we have to spend some time with it. We have to be in the midst of that difficulty and spin around in it. And then wisdom arises out of that. That's what I'm trying to say. It's not the only way wisdom arises, because like I said, these aspects are not linear. But it is in the looking of the Second Noble Truth that we are going to see the origin of suffering, the delusion that we're living out of, and that's how we free ourselves from it. So it's really just more of the subtle looking and paying attention to the subtle nature of dukkha in our lives. So we'll talk more about it. We have a whole month to kind of hang out with this. And then, of course, we'll be looking at each one of these aspects. So we're going to see. But that's just to get you thinking about it. And the whole practice this week is to get you to pay attention and think about, notice, when you have some little edge there, what are you missing? What would if I had more mental stability, could I hold this differently? I mean, that's what you're going to look for. It's what of these paths would help you see it more clearly or stay with something. I think probably more clear comprehension of what's actually going on. All right, good. Well, we need to stop because Susan is running out of time to give announcements. Thank you so much.